all the cameras, telescopes, looking at the galaxy. They really did a good job. Think back when we were doing it, we had the ranges that first went to the moon. They would just crash to the moon on purpose. We didn't know how to orbit the moon yet. We did our orbiters, lunar orbiters. And then we did a half a dozen of the surveyors that landed. No, it wasn't a rover. And of course then we went for the manned mission. And then we put a rover on. Three rovers, to be precise. So they did pretty good there for their first shot, I'll tell you that. Back to QDIC WSMI.
KH2YDT,
query.
You got
it, Matt.
Okay, I was also wondering if Paul heard anything on this comet that's supposed to be, passing this, the brightest star in late March.
A comet that's passing the brightest star. Bright star was Cirrus. It's supposed to go in front of Cirrus. That one would be the comet that the Rosetta mission that Bob would talk about that one. That one's good. That's the one I've been following. Just woke it up another couple of months ago. Actually, probably in June. They'll be catching up to it. And then they have a lander. Felipe is going to go down and land on this Comet 61 or something. It's got this real long name. Two letters. That found it. But much talking about that one. I haven't been following another one. Back to you.
Yeah, give us some more words on that one, Matt.
Okay, KH2YDT. Supposedly, I caught the end of it on the astronomy net on Thursday. He was talking about there was asteroid that's supposed to be passing a really bright star in late March, and supposedly Mineola is the best area to be watching this. That's all I know about it.
Unfortunately, I missed the astronomy net this week, but you want an update on that, you gotta get a hold of Craig. Sometimes he's on this net. And now I forget the weeks that they have the astronomy net. So they're on Thursday night, 8:30. You can look at the Limewatch site. They'll tell you. Trying to memorize is hard. They do that with the computer net, too. I'd like to see it every week. This way you won't have to memorize. Thank you, Dick.
Interesting. John, you listen to every one of the astronomy nets, so maybe you remember some of that that took place on the last astronomy net. Over to you, John.
Yes, it was mentioned, and I believe the occultation is supposed to be 17 minutes, which seems a long time for me. I don't remember what star. I thought it was Vega, but it could be Sirius. That's about all I remember about the conversation. And it is supposed to be shortly. Craig would know, of course. He's the one that was representing it. But it was very interesting, and we've never had that happen before. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Back to you, Dick.
And 2APG. Uh-huh. There's another guy who listens to the astronomy net. Dave, tell us what happened.
And 2APG, good evening. I'm monitoring the chat room as well. What Matt's referring to is there's going to be a very brief occultation of the star Regulus coming up in March. There's an asteroid that's going to pass in front of the star Regulus. So we're going to lose sight of the star for 14 seconds. It's going to be very quick, 14 seconds. And the path is very narrow. It comes over precise and limited geographic area, which actually covers part of Long Island. If you want to get more information on it, probably one of the nicest things online. Let me drop it. Somebody actually posted a YouTube video, which has a pretty neat animation of what the event is going to entail. So just do a Google search on YouTube, Occultation Regulus. YouTube, Occultation Regulus. And you'll come up with that YouTube video. And it's very informative. And 2ABG back in it.
That's good to know, Dave. Thank you. Paul, that Cosmos series done by Carl Sagan was very well done. Neil deGrasse Tyson, by way of his Nova Science Now series, some of those are very good. Also, there's a lot of YouTube videos where he is being interviewed on various subjects. A darn good speaker. If I understand correctly, he has made a brand new series of Cosmos, Cosmos Updated. Here we are, 25 years later or so. And I think you're saying the very first one, maybe it's going to be 13 of them, there I'm not sure. I think you're saying the very first one might appear in March. And do we know the date that's going to appear? And I presume it's going to be on a CBS channel. WS2N, K2LIW, that call.
No, it's not going to be on a PBS. I was surprised to find out it was going to be on Fox, so I guess Channel 5 is the station. I'll record it. I don't know if I can put this commercial, so. Got a DVR. DVD, I don't know. DVR. DVD. The bank. I'll definitely make copies. You watch it and then you say, oh, what'd that guy say? And then, you know, you gotta review it, you know. Some of these things are outrageous. So just sit there watching, you know, hour after hour as the weeks go by. I don't know how they're gonna do it. One a week, or how they're gonna work. I just found out about a couple of days ago. But, should be good. Paul Sagan left the big boy behind in 96 when he died. Back to you, Dave.
Taking you a second, West. So it begins in March. Good thing you told us it's on Channel 5 on Fox. I would have definitely gone and looked for that on PBS. So sometime in March is the first one. And what's your guess? 13 of them, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I've read went to a couple of websites and they tend to agree. So. Don't write it down in stone, but I'm going to say 13 one-hour shows. Very similar, almost the same idea that Paul Sagan did. He did 13 episodes, one-hour shows. Well, to me, it's like an update. You know, I can imagine what they're going to have. You know, plenty of astronomy stuff, plenty of origins of life. You know, he did the whole bit. You know they're going to cover Voyage. You know that. That was one of his favorite topics. He was heavily involved with Voyage.
Yeah, that space probe is way out there. Drastic understatement. The longest range piece of hardware that mankind has ever created. And I believe it's on Voyager is the, or am I confusing it now with the thing that preceded Voyager? All of a sudden I can't think of the name of the darn thing.
Yeah, 10 and 11.
Oh, sorry again, yes. 10 and... what was the model number again?
Pioneer 10 and 11.
Yeah, now both Pioneer and Voyager. They have either a picture of a man and a woman side by side with a raised hand as a greeting, and a record on board that contains all of the sounds of the Earth, hello, in 25 different languages and whatever. Do both Pioneer and Voyagers contain similar hardware along those lines, Paul? And one of these star charts with all of the repetition rates of all of the major pulsars and the directions, which when you pin that down in three-dimensional space, it tells you exactly where the launch took place. So do all those four spacecraft have similar hardware on there identifying us and where it came from? Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
Yeah, the one with the man and woman, that's Pioneers, and they have the pulsars, show where they came from. The record, the gold record, is on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, and that's the one with all the whale sounds and different languages. Jimmy Carter's voice is on there, and a lot of other stuff, and that's got a stylus attached to it with directions on how to operate this thing, you know. It's not even a DVD stick. It's an LP. Back to you, Dick.
I guess when it comes to playback hardware of a popular nature, the LP record with a stylus was sort of a state-of-the-art in 1977. 76, 77, is that when it was launched, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, 1977. And Voyager 2, one off before Voyager 1, a week or two before. But sort of the path that they took, Voyager put up quicker. And that's the one that furthest out. In fact, I just checked the other day. We're up to 127 AU on Voyager 1, and 100 and, I think I saw 104 on Voyager 2.
So that launch is coming up to 37 years ago. And in theory, that traveling wave tube, the filament, has been operating continuously. And I think there's a standby tube also. And to your knowledge, have on either spacecraft, on Voyager 1 or 2, are they still on the primary transmitter and didn't have to go to the standby transmitter? Have we gotten any information along those lines, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW?
They've switched back and forth a couple of times. Which one they're on now, I don't know. I don't know if they're on A or B. But this is some problem that they had. And their recorder is still working, you know, the data. The DAT recorder, really a digital audio tape recorder, which is nothing but put digital information on an 8-track tape, and it's a continuous loop. So it'll load itself up with information and then transmit back. I'd like to see it make it at least the 40 years, you know. They say it's going to go to 2025, so that's even beyond that.
Just think about the fact that it's got an LP record on board. It's using a digital magnetic tape recorder to record the data and play the data back. Quite possibly the motors on that tape recorder are not brushless DC motors. They're ordinary old-fashioned brushed motors. So those motors and that continuous loop of tape has survived for 37 years, being used some portion of every single week, I would guess. That is think about lubricating bearings of a motor in a high vacuum of space with temperatures going up and down and everything is outgassing, so to speak. I don't think they had brushless DC motors. So just to have the motors survive that long is a good trick. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I don't know if they had brushless ones or not. But, they still have some fuel on board. They weighed a couple thousand pounds. Half of it was fuel. And that fuel is probably down to 10 to 20%. me that much. I don't know. Someday, you know, you expect to find out, you know, that they're not hearing a signal, either one of them. But, you know, that day never comes. It happened with Pioneer. And the other Pioneer, they actually shut down. So, it wasn't funded at a certain point. But Voyager, they keep funding. I think the same thing's going to go on with the one that's going out to Pluto, New Horizons, because they're going to fund that one forever as well.
In the case of Kepler, which lost its reaction control wheels, and therefore it can't position itself to do any more planetary exoplanet measurements, and I did hear a report that they were finding a way of adjusting panels somewhere so that the solar wind will do the positioning. And it sure would be nice if Voyager had movable panels, sort of like pin feathers, if you know what I mean, that could be moved in order to do the positioning. Because if I understand correctly, you're using reaction control jets and fuel on board to do the positioning of Voyager. Obviously, it's a finite fuel source. But if they're doing it with a solar wind on pin feathers, on the tip feathers that you've got on the wing of a bird as a positioning device, that would in theory require no fuel. And am I hearing correctly that there was a proposal that Kepler can possibly do that? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I brought that up on the net probably, I don't know, a couple months ago. That was proposed, whether or not they've done it successfully or not, I don't know. I haven't got an update. But, you know, even if they lose that one, sooner or later, that's bound to happen. There's other ones in the wing, Tesla's, you know, that's going to be coming up in a couple of years, in 2017. Maybe, no, like 2016, they're going to launch that thing. That guy are out there now by the European Space Agency. Not probably involved with that a little bit, but that was launched by them. Now you've got other one, Plato, they call it. That's the newest one. Plato is going to be launched by European Space Agency as well. And it sounds very similar to test, the orbit, not the same test. That's the one with the P divided by 2, P over 2 orbit. It's going to be 60,000 miles to the lowest point of Earth and 250,000 miles at apogee. For every time it goes around, the moon will go around once in orbit. So always have a good look at the sky. You've got that one, Gaia. Eventually, there's one Plato. Whole series of these things in there. All doing similar work, looking for planets, getting better at it. Eventually, the atmospheres on planets, part of the goal. And once that data is collected, they'll have James Webb up there, and they'll tell James Webb, we found an interesting thing with Gaia over here. Let's take a look. That's going to be very exciting. So James Webb is also designed to look, you know, in the beginning of time, the early point of the Big Bang. It is going to also be a planet hunting telescope.
I believe Kepler was looking at something like 110,000 stars simultaneously. And some of these newer Planet Hunter satellites of the European Space Agency, I think I heard numbers like more than a million stars are going to be monitored simultaneously. Is that approximately correct, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, Gaia is going to be looking at that. And then what they do is they take pictures. I think within 1 year, three or four times I've gotten that. but they'll scan the entire sky, Gaia, 1 million stars. And then, you know, a month later, they'll do the same thing. Around and around they'll go. And what they'll have is different locations of the stars. They'll have the direction of the stars which way they're going. They'll be able to tell if they're coming toward you and away from you. And the idea is to set up a system where the closest million stars to us, you're going to have a 3D version. They'll put this onto a computer and you'll be able to zoom around the universe accurately within, I don't know how many parsecs, but, 1 million stars anyway, right?
What Kepler did is to stare at a very small section of space continuously. I'm guessing it did the equivalent of taking a snapshot every minute or so. And when a planet passes in front of a star, and you look at that occultation and therefore you sense the presence of that planet passes in front of the star in the matter of an hour or so. So you got to take multiple pictures every minute or so in order to sense the beginning and the end of that event. If you want to measure the whole universe simultaneously, you can't be looking at the whole universe every couple of minutes. So planet hunting and looking everywhere at once seem to be in conflict. I don't think you can do both. WS2N, K2LIW.
Kepler is always staring at one point in the sky with their 100,000 stars. Like for instance, Gaia has multiple, I don't know how many different scopes and points, how many directions, four or five or whatever it was, but they're taking a wider view. I mean, they are taking a whole view of the sky, and the way they're doing it is that spacecraft is slowly rotating. You get how many times per minute or whatever the speed is, but it's slowly rotating and they're scanning the sky. That's exactly what they're doing. Complete 100% sky survey. They want to look, actually, the 1 million stars nearest to us. And yeah, you're right, that number of 100,000 stars per Kepler. But only one spot in the sky. That's different. Totally different. That's going to do the same thing as well. It's going to be scan the whole area, not just one spot.
Kepler was a good-sized telescope aimed at one particular point in the sky, looking at 100,000 stars in that point, and I think that point was something in the vicinity of the diameter of the moon or a fraction of the diameter of the moon, by way of a telescope to get lots of resolution of those stars. If I took a fisheye lens and looked at a much greater area of the sky all at once, I'm now getting much, much lower resolution of each star. Therefore, to pick out whether or not an occultation of that star occurred becomes a hell of a lot more difficult. So we've got a conflict here. If this is the best of all worlds, I'd have 1,000 telescopes aimed in 1,000 directions. But each telescope is a massive piece of hardware. So to really resolve the occultation, you need a telescope. By definition, a telescope is a little bit like looking down a straw. You don't see very much sky all at once. So how are these newer spacecraft going to be accomplishing a much larger area and sufficient resolution to catch the occultation? You can see the trouble I'm having here, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
CCD, charge couple device, is much better with the newer Gaia, I think it's about 1 billion or something, where Hubble Space Telescope was a 5 meg CCD. They're up to a billion feet. So that's out of the resolution problem. And then the whole sky is just slowly turning.
nuclear fusion reaction in the core. Now, when it comes to some of the more recent diagrams I've seen of the magnetic field of the sun, you seem to have a north pole magnetic field near the top of the sun, and another north pole magnetic field near the bottom of the sun, so to speak. And the two of them fight each other, and near the equator they do some funny things. I've seen some diagrams along those lines. What the magnetic field of the sun is doing, and the way it powers the charge of the solar wind, and how that solar wind goes out to the end of the heliopause, and does or doesn't fight the galactic wind, that I certainly can accept is more complicated. But to say that all of that energy out of the sun is not coming from the core, I think that would be an awfully tough sell. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
Yeah, it is for me also, Dick. I mean, it's scientifically possible to do exactly what they said. The compression it suffers under the gravitational pull can give a temperature high enough, 20 million degrees, whatever it takes in the center, to ignite that core. Now, there's a lot going on with the galactic field, of course, and I don't have a clue on what's going on with that. But it seems that the space probe that's out there, Voyager 1, I think it is experiencing many things that NASA thought were not going to happen. So I'm sure in a few weeks we'll be getting some updates on that.
Have you been following any of that one, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW?
No, I'm a big believer in the gravitational field of all these suns creating a nuclear force, you know, for 5 billion years, another 5 billion more to go. I think that that's coming from an outside source. I can't consider that thing. I mean, these things collapse. Eventually, if they're big enough, they create all the different elements. To think that some galaxies doing that, you wouldn't be able to have a rogue star going along somewhere. There's plenty of rogue stars that aren't even near the, involved with a galaxy. It wouldn't exist.
What's really funny, from my point of view, is that for a couple of months in 1947, my family was living for a while in Daytona Beach, Florida, just for a couple of months. And I went to a local Daytona Beach school. I was in the second grade. And I remember the science book they gave us, and the science book explained that the sun creates all of its heat because it is burning something like wood. So, by ordinary oxygen flame is where all the sun's energy was coming from. And my goodness, was that naive. And that was a school-approved book for science for the second grade at that time. That was the book only used in the second grade today, I'm not sure. But my goodness, we would have burned up that amount of energy in about a year or two instead of 5 billion years. Over to you, Wes, KQLIW.
Interesting. According to the spectrographic analysis, which I'm pretty deep right now in spectroscopy spectrography, the sun is composed primarily of hydrogen gas, about 71%, and 27% of helium. And there are some percentage of oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, carbon, and possibly, if I remember correctly, about six other elements. But although every element on Earth could be found in the spectrum of the sun, those primary 12 elements are making 99.9% of the mass of the sun. So the theory that was created in NASA, actually, because they had a problem with the basic model on it, that the solar wind is an electric current connecting the sun with its family of planets and with its galactic clan, put in question 90 years old theory of fusion firing solar furnace, and that needs to be re-examined. So that's exactly what the John said, but going deeper into it, there is a electric universe theorist, Walt Thornhill, pretty much no scientist. What he points out is star reside with plasma, perhaps as a light they entrench. In other words, they know that the plasma, the charge is there. They actually talk about the number of neutral atoms, but the neutral atoms are charged in creating a big, huge ring or a circuit. They just don't know how that they got there. So, what he says, it is clear from the behavior of its relatively cool photosphere that the sun is an anode of positively charged electrodes in a galactic discharge. The red chemosphere is counterpart to the glow above the anode surface in the discharge tube. So the current density is too high for the anode surface to accommodate it. A bright secondary plasma forms within the primary plasma, and it is termed sort of like anode tubing of the sun. So those two are packed together tightly, so their tops give the appearance of granulation. So that's how they try to make this electric, but Milky Way appears to be primary part of the circuit powering the sun. And they further expanded that to any star, that any star must obey the same principle.
We've heard from many sources that a unipolar magnet is essentially out of the question. Doesn't exist. Can't exist. Okay. Unipolar charge can exist. Now, in the case of, if you want to make the sun highly positive or highly negative, as a point charge, so to speak, very large point, you could start making a case by saying that the solar wind, which is a tremendous amount of mass being given off by the sun at something close to 1,000,000 miles an hour, 24/7, lots and lots of particles of stuff are pouring out of the sun. If the sun's solar wind was one particular polarity, you could sort of convince yourself that, okay, if all those particles coming out of the sun are positively charged, the sun eventually is going to become a negative probe, a negative point in space, because all of its positive charge is going away. On paper, that sounds good, but there's a problem. If you are sending out positively charged particles, for instance, in the solar wind, and you think the sun is becoming more and more negative, eventually you get to the point where the amount of negative charge of the sun has such an extremely high attractive characteristic to the positive charge particles being given out by the solar wind that those particles won't go out there anymore. They'll go out, sense the attractive charge of the opposite polarity of the sun, and get sucked right back in. So to try to make something like the sun have some particular high polarity for any significant period of time, that's a difficult case as I see it, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, when I was telling about what the sun is made from, I'm going to take into consideration one thing, which is actually the fact admitted by science. We're at a certain temperature. At the temperature, the hydrogen atoms are disrupted into the individual protons and electrons, leaving the protons free to collide with another. So, it is the initial proton collision. What I explain that is that it's a reaction called proton to proton. Now, we were talking about difference of potential, but now we're dealing with the same potential, with the same positive particles, but they are being actually colliding with themselves. So when the proton collides at high temperatures, are thought to be moving fast enough for them to fuse into other particles, which would be deuterium, a positron and neutrino, and deuterium is a proton-neutron combination, where the positron is negatively charged electron, which means the opposite to the electron, antiparticle. So, and eventually we deal also with neutrinos, conventionally thought to be a similar to the electrons, except they don't carry electric charge. So big neutron is affected by electromagnetic forces, and now here we have a creation of, when we have a proton-to-proton reaction, the formation of the helium-3, which is the deuterium captures another proton while at the same time emitting a gamma ray. And a helium-4 nucleus and the two neutrinos at the end result the reaction. Now, the reason I'm telling you that and why I say about the electric universe being sort of pretty smart idea is that on this technet, there was a worry about a sort of EMP that could be made and disrupt the power in the United States, and that's by means of the gamma ray. The gamma ray actually are what eventually United States scientists are worried about, because they could ionize the matter and by that create the conductivity. There's no such thing as disrupting by itself. It must be a cause and mechanism that is beneath that. So by that, we're talking that the gamma ray actually is one of the primary forces creating ionization, therefore creating a flow of the closed circuit in the Milky Way, including the sun, and powering the sun. And to the gym.
Now, where somebody is worried about gamma rays, you've got roughly once every 24 hours with our current satellites and other kinds of detectors, you will find a gamma ray burst happening somewhere in the universe. The average galaxy has a major gamma ray burst per, I think it was 100 million years, and there's a lot of galaxies out there, so you get a lot of gamma ray bursts altogether. If one of those major gamma ray bursts occurred within 22 light years of us, everything gets cooked. So gamma ray bursts, and what are they really? Is it the collapse of a supermassive star? Is it the two neutron stars coming together? Is it a neutron star and a black hole? Is it a pair of black holes coming together? There's lots of speculations as to what can give you a major gamma ray burst. Thank goodness they're very rare per galaxy. But if one of them occurs nearby, the total amount of energy of some of those gamma ray bursts is just, it'll saturate almost any detector you've got, even though it's taking place a billion light years away, so to speak. So they are really potent. But there's no good way to protect from that. So was that one of the factors of the five mass extinctions we've had on the Earth? Or was it a collision with a comet or an asteroid? There's lots of speculations on that one. So is it a gamma ray burst that we're worried about here, Wes? H2XJN, K2RIW?
In terms of the EMP in the United States, we worry about gamma ray as the primary factor causing the disruption of the communication, disruption of the electric line, due to the ionization of the particles. But when we try to analyze the nature of plasma, the plasma is said to be a primary, when affected by the gamma rays, primary conductive medium, like a copper wire. So that's why they derive with the whole theory about not only the sun being a part of electric circuit, but also the whole star. My question is, how do you understand? If you, let's say for a moment, you would ask yourself, okay, let's say maybe Wesley is right, maybe Sanatha is right, how do you understand the sun? What is it, a light bulb at that point?
You're asking the question, is the sun a light bulb? And I think I don't understand the question, Wes. Go ahead.
Let's say the theory about the electric universe or electric sun, we take for the moment as something that is interesting to analyze. How would you then see the sun in within the electrical circuit?
I think I know what he's asking, Dick.
Try it, John. Go ahead.
In other words, like a light bulb, the galactic current going through the sun is making it illuminate or causing the furnace to fire up the light. Is that what you're asking, Wes? Back to you, Dick.
Well, that would be a tough case to make. I mean, the total amount of energy the sun is making, by our standards, is huge. The total amount of energy you can connect to another body without wires, so to speak. Yeah, I can get energy to go from the tank circuit of my 807 transmitter into a neon bulb that's a few inches away by capacitive coupling effects. Real near-field stuff. But, and their energy is being transferred with no wires. But you now take a solar distance, a galactic distance, and you try to make a electronic circuit out of that, and you try to put a lot of joules of energy through that circuit without wires, so to speak, without a clearly defined conducting path, like a huge plasma lighter, if you know what I mean.
And it would have to go to all of the suns in the galaxy, all of the stars.
And if that's where the power of the sun is coming from, and it's not the nuclear source in the center, wow, that would be a tough case to make. I won't say it's impossible, but my goodness, that looks like a dark horse to me. Over to you, Wes.
I completely agree with you, but that is one of the reasons why you were dragging today the displacement current, because when you think about a potential, energy potential, when you think about the capacitor, when you think about the magnetic field, when you think about particles being ionized by the gamma ray in within that electrical circuit, all of that counts, because all of that makes a current flowing. And when we're talking also about the amount of energy that is there, that's interesting, but isn't that scaring? Look at what is happening. I have one more thing to you. We have a sun that is 11 years spot cycle, and that should be a solar maximum.
Very true, Jack.
Production should be at highest. So, however, the lack of the sun's productivity has left solar physicists pretty much puzzled. In other words, what happened to the electric universe paradigm if we think that this is what actually is happening, determines that the sun is powered by external galactic electric currents, which cause both sunspots and solar magnetic reversals. And to share.
Go ahead, Eric.
No, I'm listening. Now, when you take a material and you get it hot enough, it gives off photons. Okay? Tell me something that you can raise the temperature up to, oh, say, 800 degrees or 1,000 degrees, and tell me that it doesn't give off photons.
Well, it turns out that every object above absolute zero in temperature is giving off photons. Those photons are at a very long wavelength when it's cool, and by the Wien displacement theory, as the object gets hotter and hotter, the amount of radiation overall, the amount of photons coming out, increases by a T to the fourth formula, and the peak of that radiation goes to shorter and shorter wavelengths. That's the reason why that piece of iron is a dull red. At one temperature, you heat it a little more, it becomes a brighter red, and eventually orange and yellow and white and green, and blue. So the wavelength of the peak of the radiation of photon radiation is directly proportional to absolute temperature in degrees Kelvin. So that object that's in a cryogenic refrigerator being cooled by liquid nitrogen at 77 Kelvin, it is emitting photons. And you get a sensitive enough infrared camera, you can measure those photons coming out of there. Everything is emitting. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
So I don't understand why we're trying to say that electricity is flowing, which is causing the emission of photons.
Yeah, without having a clearly defined electronic circuit, and most electronic circuits will obey Kirchhoff's laws, and the ones that have some fancy magnetic fields nearby, they've got to obey Faraday's law, which is more inclusive than Kirchhoff's law. But where is the circuit? Where is the, to have current flow, you usually have to have a circuit. And I'm having trouble envisioning the circuit in this case. Over you, Wes, K2LAW.
Well, that's what I was saying. The manufacturers, as far as it is being seen, when you look at the video that you didn't have a chance to see, what John saw, you would see exactly what I'm talking about. But my question, because we have a few minutes, is because of the lack of the sun activity as we should have, should we then talk about a colder climate, the colder winter that we have right now, and to achieve?
What you can say for sure is that the sunspot cycle of the sun is at least complicated. It has a peak of activity every 11 years. It has a complete polarization reversal roughly every 22 years. But you get periodic things like the Maunder minimum, where for 60 solid years, there were no sunspots. And how do you explain that? Way back in the 1600s, you had long periods of time with no sunspots. And periodically we go through things like that. So the cycles of the sun, all you can say for sure is they're at least complicated, not clearly defined. You can talk about a certain cyclicity. You can do a spectral diagram as to how often there's an 11-year periodicity. There's a definite peak at 11 years. There's a minor peak at 22 years. There's probably another peak at 110 years, and so on. So it's a very complicated motion that's only partially understood. And when it comes to helioseismotechnology, in other words, the sound waves propagating through the sun have been analyzed reasonably well. And boy, there's a whole lot of different modes in which the sun is vibrating. Over to US, K2LAW.
And to you. Well, upcoming colder climate, it's kind of puzzling me right now. We don't have a periodical fluctuation that should happen at this time. I remember the last spot. What I see, and we have a few seconds left, is that for quite last three, 11 years, we don't have a normal activity of the solar flux, solar maximums. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. In your and my lifetime, the peak of solar activity of 1957 was one of the all-time highs, but it wasn't necessarily the highest one. Go back 200 years, you might find a bigger one. And there was a huge solar outburst of some kind in roughly 1860, which the flux out of the sun created voltages built up on telegraph wires where the telegraph keys were arcing over and making phony Morse code even without nobody pressing the key down on either end. And we've had some blackouts because of solar activities that interfere, make some huge DC currents flowing in our long line transmission lines. This was TechNet number 1495 of the series. 73, you all. We'll be back next week. We'll settle a few of these things. We'll find out more of the things that are not settled. And keep all those large cards and letters are flowing. And now that we know how to get to the chat room, more guys should sign into that to give us information, even if they don't have the right equipment to talk to us live. KC2WGB. Go ahead, John. K2LIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I want to thank everybody for joining the net. And very interesting. I do have a short, tiny URL site, which I will give next week. I'll announce that site so that everybody can take that site, put it in their favorites, and they'll be able to enter with no problem. This is KC2WGB, 773. Everybody have a fun week.
Out of curiosity, John, is that the one that's on the LIMOC website?
Negative. This is one Lou just set up with tiny URL, so it'll work fine.
Is it an even more better one than the one that's on LIMOC?
Oh, yeah. It's a direct one that they can... They don't have to have that long number that Lou gave. It's a direct, path through the URL at tiny URL that will take you to the site just by entering that. So it's a much better way to do it.
You got a couple of seconds? You want to try giving it to us?
Okay. You go to that http://... Let me get the rest of the information. Okay, /... tinyurl.com/ TechNet chat room. One word.
That's an easy one. tinyurl.com/ TechNet chat room, all one word. Well done. Thank you. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Enjoy the week, and I will talk to you soon. KC2WGB clear.
Thank you very much, Dick.
Bye-bye, you're welcome.
KC2WGB, KC2YD, can you see us right to Metroplex?
John, you want to go up there?
Matt, can you go to 147, Chrysler?
Chrysler. Got it. Meet you over there, KC2YD.
Okay, Wes, 147. KC2WGB, QSY.
Go right ahead. But that's not for me either. That's for sure. Hold on one second, Rich. I think you got Gene E2IDT. I think that's Matt out there. Matt is